Okay, so welcome back again, and we can now continue with our exploration. We're going to look a little bit more at one other sutta, which is about the similar ideas of nama, rupa, and vijnana, and how this works. This is just another way of looking at it. It's not that much newer, but there's a nice couple of nice similes in here, which I think made quite clear what goes on with nama, rupa, and vijnana, how this things function and how they come to a stop and how they work together here. So this sutta again is from the Nidana Samyutta. It's called If There Is a Lust, and I will go through this fairly quickly because it is quite similar to things we have seen already, but I will comment on those things that are slightly different from what we have seen before here. So this is how it goes. At Savati, bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the assistance of those about to come to be. What for? The nutriment, edible food, gross and subtle. Second nutriment is contact. The third nutriment is the will of the mind. And the fourth one is consciousness. These are the four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be, and for the assistance of those about to come to be. These are the four aharas that we see sometimes talked about in the suttas, and these are also an interesting group of dhammas, group of teachings, that are not often talked about, these particular teachings, but also quite interesting. So what do these mean? What are these four nutriments all about? And you see here, these are things that sustain people's existence, right? Or they support you when you actually are about to come into a new existence. So these are nutriments. And the way this is to be understood, I think, is that when we crave for things, these are part of what we crave for. And craving, of course, is what sustains our existence. So because these are important aspects of our existence that we seek for, that we delight in, that we enjoy, that we crave for, they become nutriments and things that we then pushes us on into existence, cause us to accumulate karma, and then drive us into a new existence in the future. And it's a little bit interesting to just very briefly consider what these four are. The first one is edible food, right? So edible food, of course, is important for sustaining the body, but it's also an aspect of craving that is important for us, right? It's a specific aspect of craving as well. We crave for nutriment, edible food, obviously. The other ones here are perhaps not as clear what they refer to. One of them is contact. And contact then means experience, right? Every time we contact the world, it is we experience something. And of course, experiencing things is what life is often all about, right? People want to experience things. They want to travel around the world, see new cultures, eat new food. They want to see new sceneries. They want to see new movies. They want to, all these things in the world. You want to take in as much as possible. But as somebody once said, it's just more of the same, you know. It's just going around and round and round. There was a famous, very famous monk in Thailand called Ajahn Tait, and he said precisely that. When you travel around and you think that you're experiencing new stuff, it's just more of the same. It's just slight variations on the same theme. You taste something, okay, it's Chinese food, it's Sri Lankan food, it's French food, right? It's in the end, it's all food with slightly different tastes. What's the big deal? What's the big point in all that? It's like, Ajahn Brahm always likes to have a bit of fun. So he said, when he gives a talk at the monastery to the monks, he says, oh, people want to travel around the world. They want to see the wall of China. For goodness sake, why do you want to see the wall of China? Just go and see the wall that surrounds the monastery. Good enough, right? Close enough. A wall is a wall. Okay, the wall in China is a bit more impressive than the wall around our monastery. It's a bit more grand, but good enough. A wall is a wall. If you want to see, a forest, why do you want to go see the forest in, Sri Lanka has this magnificent forest, the real tropical forest, which is very beautiful. or in certain places in Burma, you also find in Indonesia, you find this beautiful tropical forest still. Ajahn Brahm says, big deal, go and see it, just go outside your kuti and look at the Australian bush, right? The Australian bush is very boring compared to real rainforest. Very kind of tiny little trees, you know, kind of looking a bit kind of not very happy where they are, too hot, too dry, that kind of stuff. But it's good enough. That's what it's all about. So this is one of the problems. You always want to experience more. But the reality is that it's just variations on the same theme. It's not that exciting, really, when it comes down to it. And the real excitement really happens in a completely different place. When you withdraw from all that excitement, when you withdraw from all those experiences, and you find the stillness and peace inside, that is where the real deal is to be found, the real happiness. And you're quite happy to chuck out all those worldly kind of experiences. But this is what it's like, right? We want to contact things. The third one is very interesting as well. This is a mental volition. This is chaitana, in other words, just the will inside of us, the doer inside of you, the thing which always wants to get things done, organize things. And it is very apparent to me that when you, that there are certain people who are very attached to being the doer, right? I am the doer in the world. I go out, I act, I do things. You see people who are compulsive doers, always working very hard, workaholics and these kind of people. And it's because they have to do, they identify with the doing. And when they do, they feel alive, right? This is what makes me feel alive, all this activity. And of course, that can be very problematic, especially if you want to be peaceful in your meditation practice, you want to chill out, you just want to relax. And then the doer says, no, you're not going to chill out. You need to do. This is who you are. This is yourself. This is your atta. And of course, if because you take it to be yourself, it means that it is very hard to let go of that doer and allow it to kind of die down. And this is one of the problems in meditation practice. Because we identify with certain things, it is very difficult to let them go. So that is problematic. So the doer people, for them, it can often be quite hard to become peaceful in meditation. Because the mind says, no, I'm disappearing. I'm no longer here. What's going on? Okay, think. Plan for the future. And then no peace in your meditation practice. And of course, the doer is also very closely related to craving, right? To tanha. Craving and doing are very close to each other. Because we crave. Craving is an aspect of doing. Craving is like looking towards the future, already planning things out in a sense. And because we crave, we also go out and we do more. So chaitana and craving are very, very closely related to each other. And this is, as I was saying the other day, people identify with the craving. We identify with the doing. That identification with craving and doing are very closely related to each other. So watch out for that. One beautiful way of overcoming these things is to understand that things become so peaceful when you start to let go of the doer. The less doing is happening inside of you, the more peaceful you are, the more at ease you are, the more good you feel about yourself, the more easy everything is, right? Good riddance with this doer, you know, there's no need for that. You start to realize after a while. So even though you do identify with it to some extent, you start to understand its non-self nature, its problematic nature, just through your personal experience. It is so important to see these things as a personal experience rather than just take, you know, the word of the Buddha. The word of the Buddha, of course, very important, but it's just a starting point. When you start to see this for yourself, that is when it becomes very powerful. So please watch that. Watch these things happening. And you can actually see how this works out, how it pans out, as they say, in real life. There is also some very powerful similes that are given elsewhere. There's a very strong sutta called the Sun's Flesh, the Puttamangsa Sutta, which comes, I think, just after this one, or just before this one in the Sanghita, Nidana Sanghita. And it kind of very graphically tells us how we should look at these nutriments. And it says, this is very strong stuff, and I think it's very useful for monastics, but sometimes lay people, you know, especially those lay people are not so used to the Buddha's teachings, they get taken a little bit aback by these powerful similes. I think here in Sri Lanka it's usually okay because people are used to kind of the how the sutras work. But sometimes in Australia, people are quite, you know, not used to these things. And they think, whoa, have I come to the right place? Maybe this is the wrong religion for me. This is just too much. I can't deal with this anymore. And you say, okay, relax, it's okay. They are, you know, you start off with the nice thing, the things that you enjoy, the things that are good for you. And then gradually you can evaluate whether these similes and these more profound teachings actually make any sense for you. So take things step by step. These are there for you to reflect on. But then gradually you will find out whether they are right or not. And these similes that are there, the Puttamangsa Sutta, is the simile of how we should regard physical food. And you probably heard the simile before. It's about this mother and father. They have a small child, and they're walking through the desert, right? And they realize as they're walking through the desert that they won't make it to the other end. All the water is running out. All the provisions, all the food is running out. And they're not going to make it. They're all going to die. So they say, well, either we all die, or we're going to have to sacrifice one of us so that the others can live. And of course, because there's only a small child, the obvious person that they have to sacrifice in that case is the small child, right? But they love the child. It's not because they don't sacrifice the child because they don't like it or whatever. They love the child. But they realize the only way we can cross this desert, get across, is by sacrificing the child. So how will they eat that meat of that child? They will eat it with sorrow, with sadness in their heart, just taking enough just to enable them to cross the desert. And the way that those parents eat the meat of that child is the same way that the Buddha says we should eat the gross food, the ordinary food in life. Right? Very, very, very powerful simile. You can see there, or actually, you're not really supposed to have too much desire for that food. Just enough to carry across, to help you maintain your samadhi, maintain your insight, just enough for that, but not more. You know, sometimes the Buddha similes are very, very powerful, and we try to kind of move in that direction, but it's very hard to kind of live up to these standards 100%. Then we have the simile for contact. And again, you will know through your meditation experience that as you calm down, you settle down, things start to fade away. It is so beautiful, right? You are contacting less of the world. The senses are fading away. There's less contact going on. There's less movement. There's not all this contact, all these images coming into you all the time. And the Buddha says the simile for contact is the flayed cow. The cow where the skin is taken off, and all it has is the inner skin, right? The very sensitive part of the skin. And wherever that cow goes, it is always contacted by all these creatures that want to eat that cow, nibble away, mosquitoes, flies. And it is very, very irritating because you're always touching the sensitive part of the skin. And wherever that cow goes, it will always be subject to that irritation because of that. So that is contact. It is an irritation. It's a problem. And again, you can see that as you, to some extent at least, as your mind becomes more peaceful. And then we have the simile for volition, the will. And the simile there is like the charcoal pit. Right? The charcoal pit is like two strong men taking you, one by each arm, dragging you towards the charcoal pit and ready to dump you inside. That is like volition. No, keep me away from that volition. Keep me away from that charcoal pit. This is painful. This is not something that I want at all. So the charcoal pit, right? Very, again, very difficult to understand, especially because we identify with this doer. But again, start to approach that by seeing how things get peaceful in your meditation practice and how the will actually is a problem. There is another simile of the charcoal pit, which I'm going to talk about later on, and that is where the Buddha says that sensual pleasures, the sensual objects of the world, they are also like a charcoal pit. And you can see this slightly in connection with this sutta, because sensual pleasures always involves craving. Craving involves chaitana, the will. So because it involves craving, because it involves chaitana, the simile is here, and the simile for sensual pleasure is the same simile. The idea that this burns you, it is hot, it is unpleasant, it is something you want to get rid of. And then we have the fourth nutriment, which I didn't even talk about yet, which is vijnana, consciousness. just the aspect of knowing, right? The ability to know things, the ability to be aware that something is happening. And of course, this is perhaps the innermost part of what we take ourselves to be here. We have the ability to know the world, the ability to understand, the ability to be aware, a very basic ability here. And that basic ability is something also we attach very strongly to. I am the knower. I am the doer, right? I am the knower. And the simile the Buddha uses for this is that somebody who is hit by spears, you're throwing spears at them, 100 spears in the morning, 100 spears at midday, 100 spears in the evening, right? And that is how the Buddha compares vijnana as a nutriment. So it's hard to grasp, right? Hard to understand how the mere fact of knowing can be considered as being struck by 100 spears in the morning, at midday, in the evening. But that is how the Buddha actually talks about this. I'm not sure exactly how that works out, because sometimes the knowing, the consciousness can be incredibly refined, like in the immaterial realms and these kind of things. So I must admit, I'm not 100% sure how to understand that. But the idea, of course, is that not knowing at all, going to complete cessation, is preferable to any kind of knowing at all. So anyway, so these are the four nutriments, right? And we crave for these things. And that is what the next part is going to say. And the next part here is really just a repetition of what we were talking about yesterday here, about how things are driven by the sankharas, how sankharas establish consciousness at a certain level and then lead to rebirth. This is what this is all about. If because there is desire for the nutriment edible food, if there is delight, if there is craving, consciousness becomes established there and comes to growth. Wherever consciousness becomes established and comes to growth, there is descent of name and form. Where there is descent of name and form, there is growth of willed activities. Where there is growth of willed activities, there is the production of future renewed existence. Where there is the production of future renewed existence, there is future birth, old age and death. Where there is future birth, old age and death, I say, that is accompanied by sorrow, anguish and despair. So this is like the whole mass of suffering, right, we're talking about before. And this is exactly the same thing we're looking at before, almost precisely word for word, the same process. Right? You have lust, you have desire for the nutriment, edible food, and you delight that, you crave for that. So because of that, you pursue that, and your mind is established in that realm of karma, of sensual desires. Because your consciousness is established in that realm, it's always finding its happiness there, it's trying to find its purpose and the aims for that realm, it means that it comes to growth. You create sankharas, you create kamma accordingly. Because you create kamma accordingly, this is the growth of consciousness, there is the descent of name and form. This is like the rebirth, right? Rebirth according to the level of your consciousness. And then wherever you get reborn, there is the growth again of sankharas, willed activities, which again is just another word for kamma. This is just repeating itself, right? Using different phrases. You can see here, this is the Buddha using different ways of explaining the same thing to make drive the point home. And when there is the growth of willed activities, again there is future renewed existence. And then this is how all the problems start. Just what we were talking about yesterday here. And then we have the other nutriments. If because there is lust, or desire is a better word, for the nutriment contact, for the nutriment volition, mental volition, for the nutriment consciousness, then exactly the same thing happening. If there is delight, if there is craving, consciousness becomes established there and comes to growth. Wherever consciousness becomes established and comes to growth, etc., 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 I say that is accompanied by sorrow, anguish and despair. Okay, so now we have a nice simile by the Buddha. The Buddha is the master of similes. One of the most wonderful things in the suttas are all the similes and the metaphors that he uses to bring out his points. Suppose the bhikkhu is an artist or a painter using dye or lac or turmeric or indigo or crimson. We create the figure of a man or a woman, complete in all its features, on a well-polished plank or a wall or a canvas. So too, if there is desire for the nutriment edible food, or for the nutriment contact, or for the nutriment mental will, or for the nutriment consciousness, if there is delight there, if there is craving there, consciousness becomes established and comes to growth. Wherever consciousness becomes established and comes to growth, then you have this whole sequence of rebirth, ending with sorrow, anguish, and despair. So, this is nice, isn't it? This is the idea that just as a painter creates a beautiful painting, creating a man or a woman on a picture with all these various colors, right? Turmeric, indigo, and crimson, these are all the different colors you use. And it makes a lifelike thing. In the same way, we are creating our future self. We are creating who we are in the future just through our mental volition and mental activities. Every time you act, every time you think something, every time the will is activated, you are creating yourself in the future. So the person you are now is your own creation, right? You think you may be a bad painter, but wow, look at this, what you have created. It's pretty good. So this is how the created activities work. We create all these things in the future. It doesn't feel like that sometimes, but that is basically how the laws of karma work with these creative activities. And then we have the reverse. And of course, that is where the really interesting part comes, how the whole thing ceases. If because there is no desire for the nutriment edible food, or for the nutriment contact, or for the nutriment mental will, or for the nutriment consciousness, if there is no delight, if there is no craving, consciousness does not become established there and come to growth. When consciousness is not established there and come to growth, there is no descent of name and form, no rebirth. Where there is no descent of name and form, there is no growth of the willed activities. Right? The willed activities have stopped. When there is no willed activities, again, there is no production of future renewed existence. And because of that, there is no future birth, old age and death. And when there is no future birth, old age and death, I say, that is without sorrow, anguish, and despair. And now comes the simile for which this sutta is quite well known, perhaps, depending on who you ask, I suppose. But this is the sutta which gives this simile for this consciousness which isn't established anywhere. Very hard to make similes for these kind of things. And it's quite kind of astonishing that the Buddha is able to create similes for things that are so subtle and so intangible, things that can only be experienced by oneself very personally. He's actually able to draw out similes for this. And this is how it goes. Suppose, bhikkhus, there was a house or a hall with a peaked roof with windows on the northern, southern and the eastern sides. When the sun rises, right, the sun rises in the east, and when the sun rises and a beam of light enters through a window, where would it become established? On the western wall, right, rising in the east, go through the eastern window, you can see the sun on the western wall. And if there is no western wall, where would it become established? On the earth, Venerable Sir. And if there were no earth, where would it become established? On the water, Venerable Sir. And if there were no water, where would it become established? It would not become established anywhere, Venerable Sir. So this is this simile. Here we have three places where consciousness becomes established, right? Either on the eastern wall of the house. So this is roughly equivalent then to sensual pleasures, the sensual realm, where consciousness then is involved, attached to, craves for sensual experiences, and attaches to all the sensual objects in the world. And because of that, consciousness is established in the sensual realm, just like the sun is established on the western wall. But let's say that we have abandoned those sensual pleasures. Let's say that that house no longer exists. There is no western wall. Well, then, of course, the sun continues and is established on the ground, on the earth instead. Just as consciousness, when we abandon sensual desire and we move up through the meditation, through the samadhis, and we start to get interested in and aspire for the jhanas and the samadhi states instead, then that is the inclination of the consciousness. That is where the consciousness wants to go in the future. That's what it's aiming at. That's its purpose. So it settles there, right? But what if it doesn't settle there? If it doesn't settle on the ground? Well, beyond the ground somewhere there will be water, right? You can imagine India kind of having water on three sides. So if the earth isn't there, it goes to the ocean, right? And then the sun can be seen on the ocean itself. And this is like when we go beyond even the jhana realms, we go to the immaterial realms, the arupa realms, then consciousness gets established there, because we have now abandoned those realms, and the consciousness now is interested in, pointing to, aiming at the arupa realms instead, because that is where our interest is. You can see this, it comes to mind right now, one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think it is the Anenja Sapaya Sutta, 105, something like that. And in that, or maybe it's not there, I can't remember now exactly where it is, but the Buddha says that when somebody is interested, like in the jhanas, that person is completely uninterested in anything lower than that, right? So when you are motivated and practicing for and enjoying the second jhana, you're not really interested in the first jhana anymore, let alone the kama dhatu, all the sensual pleasures. When you move on to the third jhana, you lose interest in the second jhana. When you move on to the immaterial realms, you lose your interest in the ordinary jhanas, because you have reached something higher, something more refined. And what was before, you lose interest in that. So consciousness is not interested there, pointing towards that, aiming towards that, established in that. That is what is meant here by this idea of establishing consciousness. So then, of course, if it isn't established on the water, where then is it established? And the answer is, it is not established anywhere. This is the apatitita vijnana, it is called in the suttas, unestablished kind of consciousness. And as you will see here, this refers here really to the consciousness of the arahant, right, that is no longer established in any of the three realms. You're no longer interested in any of those realms. Even the most refined states of consciousness in the immaterial realms have become uninteresting to you. No existence is desirable anymore. And because of that, consciousness has nothing to do. It is not resting on, not attached to, not pointing to, not aiming at any of these things. It is unestablished. This is what is meant here by the unestablished consciousness. So this is how this beautiful simile kind of draws out this point of what it means. And that's what the arahant has, this unestablished consciousness, not pointing towards anything in the future. Okay, so then we have the same thing for the other three nutriments, and we can just read through that very quickly here. So too, bhikkhus, if there is no lust for the nutriment edible food, for the nutriment contact, for the nutriment mental will, for the nutriment consciousness, consciousness does not become established there and come to growth. Where consciousness does not become established and come to growth, I say, that is without sorrow, anguish, and despair. Okay, so that is the if there is no desire sutta, and some of these suttas are, you know, often discussed by people, and people have different opinions of what they mean and all these kind of things, there you are, that is my understanding of that sutta, as far as I can see, to me it looks fairly straightforward what is going on there, at least in a certain sense. The reality, of course, experiencing these things is what it's really about. And that is the thing that we, of course, should aim for. Anyway, so now we have looked at vijnana and namarupa, the mutual conditionality of these things. And now I would like to move forwards a little bit on the independent origination and look at the next couple of links that link this whole thing together here. This is how it works. So we can say that nama rupa and consciousness together, they are what this existence is about. Our general existence is then circumscribed by the fact that we have a certain nama rupa. In other words, there are certain limits on that. But then now we're moving on to specific instances. What happens when we start to experience the world? This is like just a general framework. Okay, here we are. You are stuck in a certain existence. What happens once you are stuck in a certain existence? What is the process of perception, the process of activities that happen once you are, say, in the human realm, once you are in the Devaloka, once you are in the human realm, or whatever it is? And this is what we were talking about very briefly yesterday in the Madhupindika Sutta, this process of perception, and this is very similar to what is coming now. This is a real, tangible thing that we can deal with in this life, right? This is not theoretical anymore. This is kind of exactly what happens every moment we experience something. Right now, this process is happening in us, right this moment. So this becomes much more practical from this point onwards. So this, again, is the sutta on Paticca-samuppada, and this is the next couple of links in this sequence. Name and form is the condition for the six sense spaces. The six sense spaces are the condition for contact. And then we have the reverse. With the cessation of name and form, there is the cessation of the six sense spaces. With the cessation of the six sense spaces, there is the cessation of contact. And what are the definitions of these things? And what bhikkhus are the six sense spaces? The eye base, or the eye base, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and the mind base. These are called the six sense spaces. And what bhikkhus is contact? There are these six classes of contact. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. This is called contact. So, again, these definitions are not all that exciting. They're kind of very, quite plain definitions. And what they really mean is just that all, when we talk about the six sense spaces, this is an all-inclusive idea of the six senses, right? And the same thing with contact. This is all the type of contact there is. Contact always has to happen through one of the six senses, and there is nothing really beyond that. The word sense space, the six sense spaces, is the word salayatana in Pali. And the word ayatana quite literally means like a stretching out, like a plane of something. You have all this plane, right? The sphere, what is another good word for ayatana? When you have an eye, you have all these objects potentially available to you. It's like this whole sphere of these objects, the whole plane, the whole field perhaps, the whole field that is available to the eye, right? All of those things. So it's the field of the eye, the field of the ear might be one way of translating these things. So the word base to me is a little bit obscure, but it's this idea of this large group of phenomena that becomes available to you because you have the eye, you have the ear, etc. And the contact then, of course, happens through those sense spaces. So once you are established in a certain realm, you have the nama rupa, then the sense spaces is an aspect of that, right? It is part and parcel of what happens when you have nama rupa, and those sense spaces will then be constricted in a certain way. They're not always the same. If you get reborn in the immaterial realm, all you have is the mind base. If you get reborn in the Devaloka compared to the human realm, the sense spaces will have a slightly different quality to them because you will, the things you see and the things you do will be slightly different. So when it says sense spaces here, it means how they vary depending on where you are reborn, the number and also the quality of them. And then depending on how the quality of those sense spaces, that through that is how you contact the world. Through that is how you then experience the world. And this is called passa in Pali. The word contact, I think, is quite good for that. So this is how contact comes to be. And now the next thing then is to get an understanding for how this contact actually works. And to do that, I want to go back again to the Maha Nidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 15, because it has a nice little passage on this idea of how it is that we contact the world. Remember, contact here just means experience, right? So how is it that experience arises through this set of conditions that we are seeing here? And this is how the Mahanidana Sutta explains this. It was said, with mentality, materiality, name and form, nama rupa, as condition, there is contact. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body were all absent, would designation contact be discerned in the material body? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body were all absent, would impingement contact be discerned in the mental body? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body and the material body were all absent, would either designation contact or impingement contact be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the of mentality, materiality, nama rupa, were all absent, would contact be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, this is the source, the origin, the condition for contact, namely nama rupa. So here we have bypassed the six sense faces and we are showing the conditional relationship directly between nama rupa and passa. And that this particular passage I have just been reading out, it's very hard to understand. I'm sure those of you who haven't read it before, you wonder what on earth is going on here. This is really weird. I remember myself reading this the first time, maybe 20 years ago, or maybe more than 20 years ago, and I was scratching my head, wondering, what on earth is this? And it takes a little bit of unpacking to understand what is happening here. But actually, the ideas behind this, even though the words are kind of complicated, and I think they are probably much more complicated in English than it is in Pali, even though it looks complicated, once you get your head around this, actually, it is not all that hard to understand what is going on here. And what is happening here is that the Buddha says that for contact to be possible, you need two things, and those two things here are called impingement contact. That's right, impingement contact and designation contact. You need two types of contact for contact to really happen. And impingement contact, this is patiga sampassa in Pali, and patiga sampassa means that some form outside somehow affects the sense, right? Somehow the eye is here, and you're looking out, you are attending to something. Okay, I'm attending to the roof in this tent here. Okay, so I see the roof. So there is impingement contact. That roof somehow impinges on my sense space, and because of that, I have some experience as a consequence. So very simple, right? Well, you hear something. You probably hear my voice right now, so you hear my voice. It impinges on the ear, right? Or you smell something. Doesn't smell all that much right now, but like a bit kind of nature perhaps. And all of these things are impingement contacts, the things that hit the senses. But that is not enough. To be able to experience things, it is not enough that it hits the senses. If that was enough, we would all be experiencing exactly the same thing all the time, if the senses was enough for this. But it also takes the mind. Mental contact is also part of this. And this is what is meant here by the designation contact, the adivachana sampassa in Pali. Designation contact means that the mind takes this raw data from the senses and it molds it and it understands what is going on. Right? So when I look at this tent, the only reason why I know this is the roof of a tent is because my mind is operating on the raw sense data and it recognizes this. I've seen this before somewhere else. I was told by Venerable Metta-Vihari when I came here, this is a tent. So now I know, because I know that this is a tent. Otherwise, I might think it was a hangar or something, because it's so large, right? But no, it is a tent. And the same thing with everything else. Whenever we see something, we understand what we're seeing. We perceive things because we have learned to perceive these things in a certain way while we grew up from past lives, whatever it is. This is the mind designating things. And these two things have to come together. There's some interesting stories about what happened to people who regained their sight. They were perhaps born blind or something. And then through some operation, they were able to restore their sight when they were grown up. They were perhaps in their 30s, right? These people were thinking, yeah, I can get my sight. I've never seen anything before. I have no idea what it means to see anything. This is great, right? Wonderful. And everybody thinks, yeah, this is really nice, you know, what we can do with modern technology and operations. We can kind of fix things up again. But it was actually terrible for this person. It was actually a very bad experience. Because when they reconnected his nerves or whatever had gone wrong, and he was able to see again, all he saw was this blur of different colors merging with each other, a little bit of movement, right? He would see the colors kind of moving around because there's movement out there, but he couldn't make any head nor tail of what was going on. He couldn't recognize people. He couldn't recognize, you know, floor up or down. He couldn't recognize anything. It was just this terrible blur. And he said it was suffering. It was pain to get all this sensory impingement, which was absolutely meaningless to him. It was painful. It was difficult. And all he wanted was to get rid of that sight as soon as possible. And this shows us a little bit about what the Adivachana Sampasa is all about. It's our ability to name things, to see things clearly, to divide things up. This is a process we have learned through our upbringing, through how the brain is structured and all these kind of things. And if we haven't got that, we lose this ability to actually differentiate and see things. This is the first thing it shows us. The other things it shows us is how painful it actually can be to get all these impressions. Especially the reason why we like them is because they have meaning for us. We can use them to understand the world. But if they are meaningless, all that is left is the dukkha, the pain of having all this impingement coming into you. Completely pointless impingement on the senses and just painful. That's all it is. So this is then the idea of contact here. The idea that you need two sides of this. And that is actually quite important from a point of view of how we develop our minds. Because what it means is that how we experience the world depends on our mental state. Right? And we all know that. We all know that sometimes, you know, if you feel a bit depressed or sad or whatever, the world outside looks kind of grey and terrible. All the people look nasty, right? Because you woke up on the wrong side of the bed and you kind of things are, you know, you're having a bad day or whatever. You know what it's like sometimes. Or other days you wake up and think, wow, the world is so beautiful. It's so wonderful. Everything is so grey. And you love everybody around you. Everybody is your friend. Even your worst enemy is your friend on that day. Because it is your mindset is different, right? So how we see the world, how we understand everything is directly related to our particular state of mind. And you can see that in your own life. So the Adivachana Sampasa is something we can work with, right? We can actually change the way we look at the world. And as you practice the Dhamma, as you're purifying yourself, the world actually changes. And because the world changes, you have less suffering as a consequence. Things, your sensory experience, everything in the world start to look more beautiful and less bad than they used before. And this is very similar to the simile we were talking about yesterday, the Lonapala Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. The idea that if you do a lot of good karma, then you are diluting the bad karma. You're actually experiencing the world itself in a more positive way. And there is less problems for you in the world. So this is good news, right? If it wasn't for this way that contact has both a mental side and a physical side, we would be forced to take in everything just as it is. We'd all be experiencing the world in the same way. And there would be no way we could develop us out, develop the mind, and therefore experiencing, even in the human realm, experiencing a more pleasant abiding in the human realm itself. So that is an important thing, and I think it has a certain impact on on the practice of the Dhamma. It shows us that actually everything we do impacts pretty much on everything else. There is this thing going on here. So let us just have a quick look at one of the other aspects of this particular sutta and how this is explained here. I'm not sure if I will be able to bring this out properly, but let's give it a try. And here he says that if those qualities, right, qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body, right, if those are absent. So the first of all, the point here is that, you know, both the mental body and the material body have to be there. Otherwise, there is no contact happening here. But what is all this thing about those traits, qualities and signs and indicators? What is the purpose of that, through which there is a description of the mental body here? And the point of that, I think, is simply that the way that we know of the mind, the way that we know of the physical body, is through certain indications, certain experiences that we have. We know the mind is here because we feel things mentally, we perceive things mentally, we have mental volition, right? This is how we know the existence of the mind. We infer the existence of the mind through our own mental experience. And that is how. So the point here is that we just know the mind through those qualities. That is how we actually know the existence of a mind. It is not because we have some immediate experience of some permanent entity, some eternal chitta or whatever, which is always there. It is always through these impermanent characteristics that are always changing, always moving around, that we infer some kind of continuity in consciousness, and we call that the mind. And that is really all there is. There isn't really anything apart from those signs and indications, those experiences that we have. So the point of that is, again, just to show us, I think this is the point, that there is no permanent entity behind this. There is this movement of experience always happening, and that is what is meant here by the mind. And in exactly the same thing, the same point is made for the body as well. We know the body. How do you know the body is here, right? Oh, okay, you can feel, right, something solid. You look and you see something here, right? And this is how we know there is a body. These are the indications. These are the signs of the body. But we can't really take anything beyond that, beyond those signs and indicators. We can't say there is anything which actually exists apart from that. So again, the same thing here. So this is why the sutta is so profound, because it has all these little things in there which kind of add to our understanding and add to this consistent message of anatta, of non-self, throughout. Okay, so that is how contact arises, and once more, contact is very dependent on our mental state. Our mental state really determines how we experience that contact. And of course, the next thing, once you contact the world, what happens then? And then what happens then is that contact is the condition for feeling, and feeling is the condition for craving. With the cessation of contact, there is the cessation of feeling. And with the cessation of feeling, there is the cessation of contact. And what is the definition of these things? What bhikkhus is feeling? There are these six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, feeling born of nose contact, feeling born of tongue contact, feeling born of body contact, feeling born of mind contact. This is called feeling. And what bhikkhus is craving? There are these six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for tastes, craving for tactile objects, and craving for mental phenomena. This is called craving here. Okay, so and this particular definition of feeling and craving here is not particularly interesting, right? It just says that there's all the feelings on each sense. But again, the main point of this kind of definition is just to show us that all feeling is included in this. There is no feeling apart from the feeling that relates to the six sense bases, and all craving is also included. There is no craving apart from the craving that relates to the six senses. This is what this is really all about. And contact is the condition for feeling. Of course, when we contact the world, we have experiences, and those experiences are very multifaceted, right? We see things, we hear all of this and all of that. But the main aspect, the aspect which is the most important part, certainly for dependent arising, is the aspect of feeling itself. Feeling is like one of the core aspects of our existence, because feeling is what motivates us in almost all circumstances. Feeling is what, you know, we all want to have good feelings, and we want to avoid the bad ones. And the neutral ones, we don't really care too much about them. So because of that, I should maybe say, first of all, that feeling in Buddhism, if anyone here is not clear about that, feeling does not mean emotion. It means the aspect of existence, the aspect of an experience that either makes it positive, makes it negative, or makes it neutral. That is the idea of Vedana, of feeling here. And we all want the positive aspects. We want to avoid the negative ones, right? This is just very basic reality of our existence. So feeling is the main motivating power that drives us on, drives the volition, drives the craving, drives all our aims and purposes in life. And for this reason, as far as our samsaric existence is concerned, it is the most important aspect of the five khandhas. It is the crucial, the link, the key link, which kind of drives this whole process forward, or alternatively does not drive the process forward if we have the right view and the right action there. So this is why it is singled out. Of course, at this point, anything could have been singled out, but feeling is this crucial link. And you will see this. There's a nice little passage here from a sutta, which is hidden away in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this little passage reads as follows. Now it is for one who feels that I proclaim, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering here. Right? It is for one who feels that I proclaim these things. It is feeling that is the crucial link in dependent arising here. And if it wasn't for feeling, this whole thing would start to fall apart. It would be meaningless. If there is experience without any kind of feeling, all you do is see things and hear things, but there's no feeling involved, and that experience becomes kind of neutral. It becomes irrelevant. You know, what's the point of seeing all this stuff if it doesn't bring you either, hopefully bring you some happiness, something positive? Otherwise, it's completely crazy. Experience itself becomes completely meaningless without the feeling tone of that experience. It is said somewhere, I think in the Anguttara Nikaya, that what is the word? Sammo sadhana, I think it is. That Vedana is the sammo sadhana of sabbe dhamma. All things converge upon or meet or have their kind of purpose in a sense in feeling. Sabbe dhamma, Vedana, sammo sadhana, or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote, but something to that point. In other words, this is kind of the crucial aspect of our existence. And of course, because it is the crucial aspect, it is feeling that gives rise to craving, right? Bad feelings, we want to get rid of them. We crave for that reason. Good feelings, we want more. So we crave for that reason. So craving then comes. And of course, craving being this crucial link that sustains the process of rebirth. And because it is so closely related to feeling, this nexus between feeling and craving becomes very important. And one of the things that you see in the suttas in a number of places, and this is that insight, full understanding of feeling, understanding its origination, understanding its passing away, that is sufficient to become an arahant, that is sufficient to make an end of the whole round of suffering here. So because feeling is so fundamental, that is all you really have to focus on, and that will give rise to arahantship, a full understanding of existence itself. So crucial link, right? And then the link from that to craving. So a lot of the work that we have to do in the Buddhist teaching as monastics or as lay people concerns this link between feeling and craving. Craving is a problem. Craving is something which distorts our reality. We have to put it aside, right? And it is here in this link that we learn how to put feeling aside. you start to understand that feeling is just an aspect of experience. So you start to look at it in more neutral terms. You don't crave for it so much anymore. You start to use sense restraint to restrain your senses from attaching too much, from desiring too much in that realm. So you calm yourself down. You get a more even mind state, more upeka in your life. Everything evens out. And this is one of the first aspects of training in the Buddha's teachings. Sila and Indriya Sangvara Sila going together and calming these things down. And gradually we are reducing the craving for those feelings by moving our attention somewhere else, finding happiness somewhere else, and reducing the craving as a consequence. So this interaction between feeling and craving takes on a certain importance, and a very large part of our practice revolves around that. How can we avoid getting angry? How can we avoid getting upset by the people around us? The biggest problem in the world is always other people. I think it was said by a French philosopher, I think Jean-Paul Sartre, that suffering is other people. That's one of the things he said. There's some truth to that, right? We have lots of happiness through other people, lots of joy, but it's also very problematic. It's both sides. And that's why, you know, one of the reasons why, as the ideal monastic abiding is in the forest by yourself, to kind of reduce that contact with the world to some extent. So, how do we avoid these things? How do we avoid the sensual desire arising from all these pleasures in the world? This is such an important part of the path. I'm not going to talk about that now, because if I do, we will be sidetracked for many days. Instead, I'm going to talk about that towards the end of the retreat. And what I want to do for now is to focus on dependent origination, take it to its conclusion, and then we can come back to this idea, these core ideas of sense restraint, using wisdom, how we can use wisdom to calm the mind down and to avoid this kind of rash, powerful emotions to take hold of the mind and then do silly and stupid things as a consequence. Anyway, so that is enough for now. And we'll see you again this evening at 7 o'clock. In the meantime, just enjoy yourself and continue the retreat. Okay.